For the record, 25 minutes ago, I was in the office in a t-shirt, shorts, and soaking wet hair from the swimming pool.
I thought I heard you, and then I came around the corner about 5 minutes ago, and okay,
we
she's
not
in her office, and then I thought, boy, Jill, you know, Jill sounds a lot like Julie, apparently. So that was you. Okay.
I told John, he was like so surprised because I came bursting in at 7:30, and he's like, "Geez, this is a new look."
We are live.
Oh, wait. I had to grab some stuff for my AC meeting. So, anyway.
All right. Yeah. Well, good morning, everyone. We'll get started. It is 8:04 a.m., Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. This is a work session on proposed rulemaking, a continuation of a meeting we had yesterday. Ran out of time, so we rescheduled to continue on this morning. And, Jack, I'm just going to turn it back over to you to move through it.
Thank you, Commissioner. If you recall yesterday, the rules that were presented were almost fully drafted at that point. The stuff that we're going to be speaking about today, these are mostly placeholders, again, just to engage in some discussion on possible rule changes. And Pat provided a number of these suggestions, and he's not here today, but he told me to go forward regardless and just kind of bring them up. Again, I think he just kind of wanted to float the concept past you to see how the commission felt about a number of these items. So I guess I'll just hop right into it. 69060101.
Hey, Jack, just to make sure we get to the media one before that hour lasted, would you mind starting with those?
Sure.
Particularly the ADLS thing on page 13.
Absolutely. All right, so Commissioner Fedorchuk reached out to me, and she had some interest in engaging in proposing some rules on the implementation of light mitigation technology regarding that would essentially would provide for a waiver for any facility that does not receive FAA approval if they provide a motion to the commission and demonstrating good cause to have such a waiver. I know we had a discussion about this in the past, but at the request of Commissioner Fedorchuk, I put together a quick draft and provided to you on page 13 of this. And so I guess I'll just open that up for general discussion.
Is this tied back to the Department of Defense and a situation like we experienced with the Russo Wind project, or is this completely removed from that? Because it seems like they might be interchangeable.
Sure. To a degree, there's some overlap with that, but this is much broader than that. This is just
right.
FAA approval. Without FAA approval, we could provide a way for a waiver.
So if the FAA says you can't do it, you can't use ADLS in this location, or and there's no other light mitigating technologies available that they can get.
You know, any ADLS or light mitigating
technologies,
then the facility could apply for a waiver. Is that what this does essentially, Jack? Commissioner, that's correct. And does it require us to provide a waiver? When you say require us to provide a waiver, it allows us to provide a waiver upon a showing of good cause.
Okay. This was just so you guys know. This was something that was suggested to me by Basin Electric, actually, as you know, a potential solution to this that could be implemented through our rules.
Yeah, I've received some similar feedback.
On its face, I don't object.
On the face of this, I don't object, but here's what I do worry about with it, is that it will cause companies to go out of their way to not do a good job of applying for approval from the FAA so that they can avoid getting FAA approval.
because then they know we're going to give them the waiver.
If it has demonstrating good cause, would we be able to identify if they didn't?
I don't know how we would really track how thoroughly they proceeded with a FAA request.
Wouldn't we be able to see their filings to the FAA and the timeline and et cetera, if they've been diligent about it or not?
We could request this documentation, but again, we're not fully involved in the FAA approval process. We don't really know fully what occurred or what they could have done differently to ultimately probably get the FAA approval. One thing that's worth pointing out too is this isn't a new. We've had this discussion previously, and I know legal has had some concerns, and I just did want to point that out. And I know Brian specifically, he in a meeting as well, he expressed the concerns about the interpretation. It seems like it wouldn't be necessarily very cut and dry that this is administrative rules that the law expressed that we should be passing. It provided for an extension of one, not the other. It did not provide any sort of opening to provide for a waiver. However, I believe Basin, when they were putting this forward, they were taking this under the view that since it states that these will be implemented according to the rules and regulations that the commission provide and promulgate, that we would have the authority. So, again, I did want to point out that at least from legal standpoint, and I know when Brian said it before, which I also agree with his general interpretation, that it's is questionable.
What if we crafted this in a way that it applied to existing wind farms? You know, we initially had the requirement on new ones that were sited after 2016 or something like that. Then it went back to capture the ones that existed before that. So they're already differentiated, kind of. What if we applied this waiver only to those ones that were existing, and future ones that get built should take that into consideration when they're planning their project then? And so we don't build in this incentive for new projects to come up with the intention that we'll just never try very hard and then they'll give us a waiver.
And that's where the law is right now, and that's my interpretation and why when Russo was here I made that argument, because that's the way the law is set up right now, and I believe the way our rules are set up now as well.
Our rules address that as well.
Yep.
Well, so you think we can give Basin a waiver?
Well, if they have an existing facility and they're saying we can't put it on the light mitigating technology, and we can give an extension due to technical or financial inability to actually implement it, which the FAA would be a technical inability.
So why is Basin concerned about this?
I think they were thinking forward towards new facilities that they may have an interest in.
Oh, okay.
How would we identify, and I'm not opposed to it on the surface either, but how would we identify if a company was pursuing a type of technology that they knew was probably 3, 4, 5, 6 years out from receiving FAA approval, something that's being used in another part of the world, who knows? And just because of the approval process, takes a long time at the federal level, but they use that as a mechanism to not have to implement it in the near term, say in the next 5 years. How would we know that, okay, it exists, but I don't understand how long it really takes to get something pushed through the FAA to change an approval type. And I'm just, it's more of a devil's advocate type of a question, you know, because they're saying good cause, but I think at times, are we going to really know if it's indeed good cause or not?
That is difficult because, again, like you know, Jack pointed out earlier, I don't know the FAA process. I don't know how to manipulate that. I don't even know if there's a way. I don't think there's any way I could learn that without really spending a lot of time digging into it. So it's one of those things where we're kind of at the mercy of another agency that they're going to make their determination, and it'd be very difficult for us to really get into that. So that is where the problem of this really does lie. It's very difficult for us to understand what they what they make their base their decision on and be able to really dissect that in a case like this.
And I'll just say, so no one gets the wrong impression, I don't think we have any examples where that has occurred.
No.
But what if it did down the road with
somebody
else?
But you guys, if the legislature weighs in on this, it's likely going to be providing us a waiver if they can't get it, a waiver authority for projects that can't get approval by the FAA. And we're going to be in the same boat. I mean, it's not going to be any easier for us to determine the legitimacy of the company's efforts.
I was not really thinking about legislative pushback on it, and I don't think very many legislators follow our rulemaking process until it is approved by the Attorney General and on the way to the Administrative Rules Committee, and then just that one committee pays attention to it. So that wasn't my thought at all. My thought has just been about, are we setting up a situation where companies will know that all they got to do is sandbag with the FAA and be really sloppy about applications, and then they know they never have to add this technology on future projects. I do have, and now I've been more comforted by it, great concern. I don't want to set, like, Basin Electric or if there's anybody else that falls into that category with existing facilities that they're not going to get approval. I certainly want to have us have the option of waiving that requirement on those, but I guess I'd just be repeating myself. I do have concerns for the future if we do this, though.
I wouldn't. So if we look at the Russo example again, my issue with that and wasn't that our rules didn't allow for it, it's that that our rules and law didn't allow for it. If the law were to have changed to allow the example in this next legislative session, if that would happen, if our rules remained the same, I don't think we would have that same problem. I think if the law allowed it and our rules didn't address it, we could still issue the waiver at that point. So this one may be one that we could sit on and wait and see what happens legislatively before changing the rule, because if it's changed in law, we can change our rule later to match that, but I don't think we would have to do that simultaneously or right away. I think we could wait on the rule change to see what happens legislatively. That is another option.
And realistically, that's probably a difference of 5 months, more than likely, between at this point, between rules promulgated and statutes being put into place, or if they felt that there was an emergency, they could even enacted so it's implemented earlier as well. I guess I would say, at least from staff standpoint as well, that it isn't so much that we're concerned about the stepping into the role of the legislators. I think we were just looking at the plain reading of the statute in and of itself, and that's our interpretation of it, and that's where we make our interpretation. We don't look really at what a legislator says or 10 legislators says, we look at what the body drafts, and then that's what we take as legislative intent, because that's what the courts take as legislative intent. But also, I guess, up that line of thinking as well, I think the bigger concern probably was, since we had that existing facility out there, if we were going to be subject to some sort of legal challenge, it probably would occur either right after the rulemaking is actually finished up, because there's an opportunity for challenge there, or it would be when we actually implemented the rule, probably with a facility. And I guess with that in mind, that might be worth looking at, because I'm not sure when we will have one. It'd either be the rulemaking would be challenged, or it would be at the point where, say, the rulemaking is published, Russo comes back and says, now allow us to go forward with our project. And subsequently to that, if there is someone who has an interest in not having that facility cited, or having the lights off on all facilities in the states, that's where they would have the opportunity to challenge us at that point in time. Which, again, that would also be pretty far down the road as well, probably well into the legislative session.
I think it's pretty unlikely that local residences out there who are going to be concerned about that are going to bring legal challenges to our rules if we adopt something that allows waivers. The challenges will come if there's not a waiver allowed, and then there's not really a rule to challenge. So I don't know how the companies challenge something that didn't happen, I guess, by going to the legislature.
Sure.
But I guess I've already said it.
While I don't think, you know, maybe the people in proximity to that facility don't come forth as you're saying, and I would agree it's probably not terribly likely, but at the same time, it doesn't mean they won't be unhappy about it. I think this, here's what I'm going back and forth on, well, is this our role or is this the role of the legislative body? Because this issue is vetted extensively. You know, it was a prominent issue in the last session, light mitigating technology. It was a promise to the people of the state, and now does it appear, if we change this rule, that we are changing the rule to accommodate industry? And under the assumption that the legislature just missed the fact that we should have had a little bit of flexibility on light mitigating technology and having the facilities darkened at night, I think it's potentially a slippery slope, because are we listening to both sides of this particular issue, both the public that want the skyline to be dark at night, or are we just listening to an accommodating industry? And I know it's unique. You had, Randy, or Commissioner Crispin, you had said something earlier about for existing facilities versus new construction.
Yeah. When Basin Electric was brought into the discussion, I was assuming we were talking about some of those kind of handful up there near Max that they have that are kind of in this area that, you know, are pretty old facilities already. And, you know, if they're too close and can't get a waiver, that's the kind of, I think, because they were existing way before anyone was even talking about light mitigation technology, I certainly would hope that we're able to give them a waiver. And that's what I'm hearing, that we can. And I don't know if Basin knows that, if this request from them is purely about potential new wind farms, or if...
It is.
It is? Okay.
I guess that it isn't a full waiver. What it would be is we can provide an extension. So, for example, if you've been operating for 15 years and they say, listen, we can't put this on, can we get an extension of implementation requirements? And you said 10 years is your extension, that's more than likely the life of the facility.
So the extension isn't limited to an indefinite extension?
The extension is set at what the commission at the commission's discretion.
Well, I don't know. I just felt like we needed to run this up at Lakepool. This was suggested to us a long time ago. You know, I'm not very happy with the approach we've taken on this in general. I feel like we've been digging our heels in and not being very responsive on this issue. And I just don't feel like we're being in line with what is intended on this, in this law, and it's frustrating. But if you guys want to wait till the legislative session, then we can iron it out there. I just feel like I just don't feel like we've had the right touch on this one, or that we have been as responsive as I feel we should be as an agency on issues like this. This is could have been a lot less complicated. But
if the commission would want, since we are moving forward with legislative changes as well, I have been working on making some of the changes that were suggested from that last meeting. I wouldn't have a problem working on something like this too, and I have actually been, when going through it, thinking about that. So if you want, Julie, I can talk to you sometime before that next meeting, and we can look at maybe finding some way to change Century Code to help us along in this process too. So
I think I kind of like that concept better, because there's a different subject we're going to get to that I thought might be more appropriate in a Century Code than in our rules.
Sure.
But maybe since it's the rigidness of the law that was passed, and was it last session or the one before, that we're looking to partially waive, maybe we should just bring a bill to do that and have it carefully worded and go that route.
Right. And I guess when the reason why that wasn't in the previous legislative discussion is because I think I reached out to the three of you and asked if you would like to be proactive on making a change with that to enable that. And I was provided feedback that you believed it was going to be changed regardless, and for the most part, and that we probably, it wasn't probably something that the agency needed to be overly engaged in. And so that's why it wasn't already promulgated in the last packet.
Well, I strongly suspect it will be brought up. But look, you know, this has been around, so it was stated, this has been around for a long time. It's been a lingering or an issue talked about for an extensive period of time. This seems like a pretty basic piece of language that wasn't put in the last session. Why not? I mean, was it talked about during those hearings?
There was no thought that there has been an example where they had come in and talked about this, and previously the base had issues with these towers, so all of this just kind of came up in the middle of that project. So I think that it wasn't anticipated.
I know Brian and I both looked at the legislative discussion in the legislative history, and that we really didn't find much discussion. And I do recall going down there with you, Julie, and it was pretty late, and I don't think everything was entirely thought through.
Would be a change to address a specific
issue? It's really a change that affects one area. I mean, this is around probably airports, air bases, and the ballistic missiles sites. That's what's causing a lot of these FAA issues. So I mean, realistically, this is a fairly isolated problem, which is probably why it didn't get discussed or thought of at the legislative level the last time this went through.
See, I was actually thinking the alternative when we look at it, that it isn't necessarily an isolated spot. It's more than likely around the air base. You're going to see the brunt of it around in that area. But we have airports across the state. That's going to probably get in the way of a number of different facilities out there. I imagine there were some even discussion about flight training patterns and so forth, and how that may impact FAA approval, go through some sort of clearinghouse as well, which could, in some states, it extends well outside of the probably a normal ICBM area, but where their kind of flight paths and their training operations go as well. I definitely agree, though, that it's more than likely going to be limited to a very specific area. But I think there is the chance that, just like the legislature didn't think about things, we're not thinking about all the things that the FAA might not provide approval for as well.
And that's why I think it was very clear in all the legislative discussions that we, the experts, the agency that's going to be dealing with this, should be working with our rules and the FAA to make sure that these things work in tandem. And that is in the law. I mean, maybe it wasn't specific, perfectly crafted, and there's this loophole, but that, you know, we can't go to a legislature to prescribe every single thing. That's why they gave us the authority to write the rules to implement this. And if we go to the legislature and try to open up the law on this subject, who knows where it'll end up? Who knows what they'll decide, what the industry will push for, what they'll ask for. Maybe they'll decide it's not working, we don't want to do any of it, and advocate for no light. I mean, the minute you start opening up the law, you've got a whole different future on the table that we cannot predict nearly as well as changing our, making a small tweak to our rule.
I think one thing we need to really remember here too is this is still very new. There's only one style that's approved by the FAA at this point. Technology hopefully will progress faster and help us get out of this thing too. But another thing is we kind of told Russo to go and address this legislatively. So I think that can's going to get opened whether we do it or they do it. But maybe we don't want to be the ones that open the can.
So I guess I wouldn't mind some direction on whether we'd like to promulgate some rules on this, whether we can move this over to a legislative draft to propose, or
can we take up the other one and see once whether we're going to be doing a legislative draft anyway on this kind of general subject?
I apologize. Take up the other.
The change that's on.
We're talking about the
earlier page.
The ICBM sites or the.
Yeah.
Sure. We can discuss.
Yeah.
We can discuss that and come back to it if you'd like. It's, to me, they're not. I mean, they're somewhat related, but they're not completely related from that standpoint.
Jack, is this become an issue in terms of, it's clearly targeting a specific case which we ruled on, and now to change the ruling on that case where, I mean, the language was clear, it said must have. It wasn't, you know, probably should have, it was must have, and that's how I based my vote on the wording. And even though I don't believe that's what the legislature intended necessarily, they intended for the skies to be dark. Now we're in this specific, a very unique case because of the Department of Defense and,
yeah,
and the missile sites. And you know, I get it with the military. I'm not saying darken that facility if it's built. Because of their concerns, which are placed a lot of weight on that, but now are we essentially changing the rule to then be able to change a decision?
We would be changing a rule, but that wouldn't be necessarily to change a specific decision. That's to change a whole way of operations, a whole policy that will be going forward. That, you know, that's like enacting a new statute. So once that comes in, any new, including Russo. But I guess I wouldn't have any concern about a subsequent change to an individual site as a result of once a, I would be, if we didn't do something or there wasn't a statute change, then that gets a little dubious. We'd have to have a rational basis for some sort of departure from our previous decision. But the if once we go through the process, I think that at least gives us some more assurance that.
Yeah, that's what I've been going back and forth on, the fact that this essentially is joined at the hip with a specific case that we've recently ruled on.
I guess I just see it as that case happened to highlight the problem. It's not something that we're striving to fix just for that case. It's just what brought it to our attention.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Everybody's attention.
Yes.
Right.
But did we want to move forward a little bit and then try to come back to this at the end?
Sure. I think we've lost.
Maybe we should.
No,
hold.
I'm here.
Okay.
I just had to go get my coffee. I've been listening.
All right. So we'll just quickly move on, then I'll try to come back and wrap it up. Wrap it back around.
Maybe I should ask Steve what the range on the microphones are. I might need a refill at some point, too.
So we put together a stakeholder meeting a while back, and to be honest, we were pretty surprised that as many people were engaged as they were. The wind industry showed up. The Air Force, the DOD, and the Clearinghouse as well sent representatives to have a discussion regarding the ICBM setbacks, which I know you are all very aware of, and I know you've also been receiving some correspondence from wind as well regarding these matters. After we had a number of stakeholder discussions, which I'm really glad that Brian did this now, we spoke about writing something down so we have at least a path to go forward. And Brian, I know, put together a memorandum for you guys.
Brian Johnson.
I apologize.
For those listening.
Brian Johnson put together a memorandum just kind of outlining our discussions. And I guess his suggestion, I kind of asked him to take it away on this specific issue.
So I did produce the memo. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that. It is kind of the same thing. It's do we want to be proactive here and make a decision, or do we wait and see if the can's open legislatively? I just from the feedback from our military stakeholders and the importance that was put on national security of military assets, I think it is something that we're going to see. And in discussions with industry and military, the military would really like to see it in the exclusion area. They would like the hard and fast rule that's just off limits. They did state that they were open to working with wind. I don't think it's their preferred, but that's why I drafted it and put it in the avoidance area. That way a project wouldn't be necessarily stopped from developing within that 1.5 miles, but they'd be able to, they'd have to work out with military what they were okay with building inside of that. So that's really the middle ground, I think, in all of this for everybody involved. I don't think it's a bad place to put it. It could very easily be taken and put into exclusion area and dealt with there. It's entirely up to you guys where you'd want to see that. But it was kind of put out that the Clearinghouse takes care of these kind of issues and that we don't really need to. We had at one of the meetings, I believe it was the current head of the Clearinghouse here, explaining how that process works, and that's not how it works at all. Things go into the Clearinghouse. If there isn't any objections, then they don't do anything. The Clearinghouse is just another place for everybody to lodge their complaints and move forward from there. So again, if somebody would happen to miss something, it's not like they just have a checklist and the project is approved or disapproved based on what's submitted to the Clearinghouse. There's a lot that goes on there. So I do think this is something that we probably should take some sort of action on, whether in the rules and not leave it just to the Clearinghouse process.
Brian, maybe one thing that you could clarify for us is when the military came in, they seemed to indicate that 2 mile was the minimum that they wanted. However, they also noted at that point in time that they're like, well, that we could work within a couple of turbines here or there within that location. And is that why you came to the 1.5 or for your recommendation?
I guess I thought it was 1.5. Maybe that's a drafting error on my part. I thought
be mistaken too. That was just my recollection.
I thought we were dealing with 1.5, so it's either 2 or 1.5. I guess is the one we can go with. I'm sure the military would be more than happy to have 2, and I don't know that would really change all that much either to have that distance. I think even I suppose draft a 2 mile in, or a 1.5 in avoidance and a 2 mile in exclusion, or work out something that it could be less restrictive the further out you got, and kind of address both parties' desires that way as well.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that might be a little bit more difficult, but it wouldn't be impossible.
In the previous subject, was brought up about, like, well, do we want to open this can of worms? One thing I'll say, though, the wind industry, and they're not alone. There's a few other industries that have major lobbying forces, and they're not shy about bringing their own legislation and lobbying hard for what they want. So in cases like that, I kind of figure, well, this stuff's going to come up if they're interested in it anyway. Mm-hmm. So with this specifically, why I wanted to combine the two, because it probably does get into whether are we going to open up legislation as far as wind and lights and siting and all this anyway. I think the avoidance area is a nice middle ground. And so whether it be by rule or by a suggested century code change, I kind of like that. But everything that I had heard from the military was 2 miles. And to me, you know, that we've never heard anyone bring any evidence to dispute what the military says, that it's a security issue to be closer than that. The dispute is always, well, landowner rights and economic development. You know, we want to do this, build there. And so I have no evidence on the record to suggest that the military is wrong about the national security part of it. So I would have nothing to base a decision on to come up with a number of any less than 2 miles. Now, the economic development argument to that, that could also go the other way. At some point, do we put so many wind farms up in an area where they cease to do certain military operations in North Dakota and instead take them somewhere else? To me, this is a pretty big balancing act that kind of seems ripe for a larger body to make a decision on, like the legislature. And so I kind of looked at this and thought, this is a good one to put into a bill, I think, as an avoidance area and at 2 nautical miles, and let these groups kind of have it out in front of a large body that represents all regions.
I guess, and just my general opinion on this, I actually feel that this is a good place to promulgate rules on. The statute sets forth that we're going to set forth these and guide the siting process and set forth our excludence and avoidance areas or whatever policy things that we need to take a look at in favor of the public interest. So this seems like the type of thing that falls smack dab within that. I could also say that I was called down to a legislative discussion with a couple of legislators on this matter, which actually it was kind of out of the blue. The military and the DOD, I think they showed up as well to have this discussion with them. And I can tell you that the legislators were pointing out that, well, the commission in and of itself on these type of matters, they have a lot of expertise, and they have no doubt that this will probably be taken up in some form or another, or at least evaluated by us in some sort of conclusion, even if it means not doing a rulemaking at all.
If we do a rulemaking, I will just say I could not support going less than the 2 nautical miles because I've never heard any dispute that that's a national security issue.
To
your point on that, Randy, we haven't had any sort of a record developed on this yet because we haven't proposed any rules. We've just had kind of private meetings. So we don't have a record because we haven't asked for one because we haven't proposed anything. So that would come, I think, and there would be an opportunity for industry. I don't know that they'll do it, but they would certainly have an opportunity to dispute the rationale of the 2 nautical miles. But I agree with you that 2 is the number we should use, 2. And then we can change it from there based on what we hear.
And yeah, we will have that future hearing opportunity, but as our starting point, I think that's where it would have to be if we go the rule route or the legislative route, in my opinion.
Jack can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the exclusion and avoidance areas are only spelled out in rule. I don't think they're actually defined in century code.
For the most part, there are a few exceptions where the legislature did step in and say, this, we have a very specific interest in having this sort of avoidance or exclusion area. But for the most part, they left it up to the commission to make some sort of evaluation. Inhabited residents, and in the certain instances, certain wind setbacks. Those are the few. I also would just like to kind of put it out there too as well that I think when Brian was drafting this, I think his original draft even had the exclusion and an avoidance area separately, because again, this is a placeholder. This is his recommendation. There are probably additional options, as well as making sure that the 20th Air Force Wing has notice, and also possibly putting down as a policy criteria. That way, as part of the application process, they have to address it and provide us with, well, we did reach out to them, and this is how we know this isn't going to have any sort of impact on their military operations. At least it provides more clarification through the actual siting process as well, without making a hard and fast rule on this. I know the commissioners, from the correspondence that we've received from the wind industry already, that they are of the impression that, well, the DOD is already notified. They're actually one of the agencies. And so if they really wanted to provide input on a case-by-case basis on these, they could. And at this point in time, there hasn't been an issue. At every single instance, the wind facilities have moved them beyond any sort of interference. They've come to some sort of balance ground. And to make these hard and fast rules would stifle development. But you're right, that absolutely, we could go forward with whatever you guys feel. We can create a record, and we can make it a little bit broader. That way it provides, in our notice, the opportunity to adjust it and be flexible with what's ever necessary, whether it's an avoidance area notice or so forth.
Why don't you give me a few more sentences on... Okay, so this is for an energy conversion... for a energy conversion facility. Can you define facility versus a turbine location? Sorry. So if it says 2 miles, is that the facility if the project footprint, for example, is 20,000 acres? Does that mean no part of that 20,000 acres can be within 2 miles of a ICBM site, or is it just an individual turbine can't be within 2 miles of an ICBM site?
If you look, this is additional exclusion areas for wind energy conversion facilities, so it's specific to wind energy.
Right.
I guess nobody's really brought that up in our discussions before, but I think it's the turbine and their height that causes an issue. I think something on the ground, there's other exclusion areas. The 30-foot line of sight rule, I think, takes care of anything that's on the ground. But we could definitely clarify that it applies to towers versus just the footprint of the facility.
I think that in the concept of
what's the military looking at? Just the individual turbines? Or are they looking at that overall footprint? I thought it was the turbines and the line of sight and that 30-foot from blade tip to be able to. Be able to communicate from one missile site to the next.
The previous rulemaking, we discussed that the line of sight radio interference.
Going forward,
this is kind of a separate thing because this is much broader. But they have a lot of interests or concerns about even flyways being able to come in and effectively defend the missile sites and so forth, and a number of other concerns as well with the lighting and everything else as well.
It's unique in the fact that these sites are small parcels of land surrounded by private tracts of land. So it's a balancing act because this does have the potential to significantly impact landowner rights.
I think we should go forward with the wind area is really good, applaud you guys for suggesting that. I agree with Jack that this is the type of thing that we have more expertise on and experience with and a process for that I think lends itself to developing rules like this. And So I think we should develop this rule and the other rule and bring it forward and see if we can address both of these issues through that process. We'll get a lot of feedback from industry and try to get this stuff taken care of before the legislative session.
Are you suggesting proceeding with this one at 2 nautical miles, though, or still at 1.5 as drafted?
I think 2. I agree with you, Abby. I don't recall any, unless Brian and Jack have had conversations with industry and that group that have suggested 1.5 is workable. I think we could start with 2. I mean, if we did 1.5, we'd certainly get information from the industry on why 2 would. Or from the airport, I would assume why 2 is the right amount.
Brian,
so,
if you...
I think where the 1.5 came from was the military brought down a pilot and did a great job of explaining why this is an issue for them, right. And a lot of really technical information, great presentation. I hope he comes down if this happens again, that we get to talk to him, because, I mean, that's really who this is. It's designed to. He's in charge of a crew that's defends missile silos, and it's his job to get them in safely, and this is a direct impact to that. So I think the 1.5 might have stuck in my head as the minimum that he needed to operate a helicopter. So that was the bare minimum, and I probably just transposed that in there instead of the 2 that everybody was talking about. So I apologize for that.
And I think that it's been a while since we've actually since we had this discussion, because I think before the coronavirus we had intended on having this discussion way back then. But if I remember, Brian, there was also a map with multiple layers from half a mile to like mile and a half, and I think there was different levels of how critical they were. And at this point, it was, I think they maybe at that point they listed as a different. I don't. I'm just trying to jog our memories, but there might have been some different levels of danger as well.
I think that's right. So again, I don't think I've got any problem going to 2. I don't really think that changes this drastically or the discussion that's going to come out of it. So,
although I came into this thinking this was definitely needed to be legislative, I guess I've kind of been convinced that we could do it in rules. If we drafted this simply but made it 2. And then in the course of the discussion, realized that it should be a two-part thing where up to some distance should be exclusion, and then from there to another distance, avoidance. Is that still close enough that we could do that without going through a whole new hearing process?
We would be able to write our notice broad enough that we could actually do a number of things. We could say we're going to promulgate rules to effectively try to mitigate some sort of impacts to military operations within the area. We'll have a proposed rule because we do that, but we would probably provide the opportunity to do a number of things, including just, for example, I think it was it Nebraska or Oklahoma that they think required notification. That's where they ended up after looking at setbacks, and they just said, really, we just need to make sure they know about it and that they can come in and say something. And I think other states may feel differently. So,
okay. Well, then in the interest of time, because I know Commissioner Fedorchuk has another appointment, I am okay with drafting this one up and proposing it and make the notice broad like that if we started out at the 2 miles, though. And then if we're not crafting legislation to deal with this wind industry issue, I guess I'm okay with proposing the other one and going forward on a rulemaking hearing. But I just want to emphasize, I'm not saying no matter what the information that comes in that hearing that I'm necessarily going to support it, because I'm still not sure that one shouldn't be a legislative decision as opposed to us, but we can at least proceed with the hearing process.
Sure. So,
in my opinion,
what I'm hearing, and I haven't heard from Brian yet, though, is promulgate rules for these 2, and I guess I wouldn't mind hearing your take on that, Brian.
You can certainly do that. I'm still weighing out. I have less concern, frankly, with the addition of the ICBM launch facilities and having a, I'm fine with 2 miles, but I think we're going to want to, as long, you know, based depending on the definition of energy conversion facility, wind energy, because if the facility again is a 20,000 acre footprint and you start, and it's not like the military advertises where the ICBM sites are, even though you can essentially see them from the road. But for security reasons, I don't know how accessible that is, nor would I be terribly comfortable saying, well, here's the map of all the sites. It's probably out there. I was looking, you see general references, but does that in effect knock out all of North Central North Dakota from a landowner perspective?
If you look at the maps, it would take out a notable portion of the state or make it very difficult to develop wind in that whole area.
Yeah. And, you know, is that fair to the landowners, the private property owners in that area, if that's how the language is? So that's just, you can...
I can say that
was... that's the intent, but...
Right. I can say that was never part of any discussion, and as I move forward with this, I'll vet that concern as well and make sure that that's not, that we're not talking about that. Nobody ever discussed zero wind development. This was about moving turbines back from the actual
site.
Right. Yeah.
No, and that has been the discussion. I know that's what's driving.
But I will vet the concern that this isn't going to have a far further reaching impact and exclude a facility exclusively because of that. I think that's what you're saying.
Right.
So I guess for a little bit more direction, Jack had mentioned that we could build in a notice that they have to discuss, contact the military and have a discussion. Would you guys like me to build in a notice requirement as part of this as well, or do we want to just leave it as this? Like where the setback is 2.0 nautical miles and that they also need to contact the 20th Air Wing Division as well, or I guess that would go in a different location of the required agencies to be contacted. We could add that into that list as well.
And actually, I did make a note in here as well for part of the discussion when we would have gone in order. That would have been one of the first things we said, as well as addition of all these other agencies, is the 20th Air Force Wing as well, as part of the designated agencies and offices that need to be notified.
And I don't have strong feelings about it. I'm okay with it. I don't know. But there is something else I want to discuss, too.
Okay, sure.
I don't know if anyone else has strong feelings about that.
About
adding in a notification of the whatever the exact terms were for the various military groups?
Making them a designated person or an organization to, I guess, contact.
Oh, on the list of...
Right.
The growing list.
The growing list.
Julia can't hear you.
Oh, sorry about that. I think that makes sense since they are the group that raised the greatest concerns on this, and they are currently listed in, you know, I think it's a much broader notification to the military, and we know that this is more specific, the right contact for these concerns, then they should be included.
Okay. Yeah, they have to be. If we're going to list that as a rule,
sure,
they become the expert, really, in terms of telling us that this is or isn't a concern for them.
Okay.
So we don't miss something.
Sounds good.
Okay. Can I bring up another one that we haven't discussed yet?
Sure.
On page 3, on the citing fee refunds, I don't mind the first major part of that change, mm-hmm. but on the less than $50, I don't know why we'd bring it up, because if we have some small amount of money, I don't know why we'd trouble ourselves with that. I've never heard of anyone gripe about that they had $3 left in their account and we didn't spend $20 sending it back.
That was a result of the Josh, when he was here, we had a long discussion about that, whether we can actually not give like $40, $30 to $20 back, and the answer was we have to give that money back. So we have been doing this. That's the only reason why we took it off.
Okay, I'm sold. And the other one?
It's like a bank saying, you know, you only have $27.83 in your savings. We're going to keep that.
Or maybe that's the audit we want found rather than something else. But anyway, okay, I'm okay with leaving it then.
Okay.
But this one you're not going to talk me out of.
Okay.
On page 11.
I object.
I'll be the sole dissenting vote. We cannot, on page 11, have the residents, TS, doing these waivers where you know, the custom combining crew or a group of hunters rents a farmhouse somewhere for a couple of months and grants waivers on behalf of the landowner.
Sure.
It's got to be the owners that do that.
The portion for the owner of the residence, of an inhabited residence, is actually in statute. It's just it wasn't in a rule. And so we put it across there because what we did is, so it says within 500 feet of an occupied residence, this area essentially cannot be developed. That's an avoidance area unless waived by the owner. That's actually in the statute. We expanded it to school, place of business, and so forth. So really all this was trying to accommodate was the owner of a business as well and probably the school district and so forth if they were going to waive it as well. And so regardless of if we do anything about the residents in there, that's actually in statute.
Is it in...
I'm not following you, Jack. What we're adding, this one may be waived by resident or owner.
Owner would, as in the owner, and yeah, I just quickly tossed that in there after discussion with Pat, because the owner would be, for example, like a place of business or essentially whoever owns a school or, you know, that type of building as well. So in the statute as it currently states, areas within 500 feet of a occupied residence, I believe, is occupied inhabitant, I can't which word it is an avoidance area unless there is a waiver provided by the owner or of the inhabitant or inhabited of an inhabited residence. So we didn't put this in our rules, but that is in our in the statute. So that's how we have been operating. And in fact, we have been actually granting waivers for businesses up to this point too, even though it isn't in the rules. And so this was just to expand the rule to accommodate our already existing practices.
Can I just say the owner then to get to Randy's question? The avoidance area may be waived by the owner.
Sure.
That would be the owner of the residence or business.
Yeah, we can change it however we need. This was just kind of a placeholder for discussion. At the end of the hour, I just quickly wrote a sentence in there so we could discuss it.
And all the language about the school or the place of business, that's not new language. At least it's not underlined.
That was already there, right?
Yeah. So all we're doing is addressing the waiver, mm-hmm. and I just think it can't just be a resident who happens to be there temporarily. I think it needs to be the owner.
The statute already provides that the owner can waive it in the actual statute in and of itself. This is our rules and regulations.
We're just making our rules consistent with statute.
Okay.
Right.
And the statute says owner.
Right.
Yeah, statute does not say residence or owner.
Right. And
it says owner, right?
You know, I believe it's by the owner. I think that's correct. So if we did just put owner, what that would do is, you're right, it expands it to the waiver now provides for the residents and also a school and place of business. Those can be waived as well. And that's expressly put out then in our regulations, which, again, we've already been doing in our citing process.
Okay. So we're going to move residents or...
jump off, you guys. Sorry, I have to call into this medical advisory committee meeting that started at 9. So, you can continue working through these if you'd like, and I can share any objections that I might have if I have any. I've read them, I didn't understand all of them, or we can set another time, but either way, I have to go.
So, you can share any objections or glowing support for conversations. Commissioner Christman and I have.
For sure. Yeah, I can do that as well. I'm not going to listen to the tape over. Sorry.
Fair enough.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye.
So we are comfortable then going forward and just putting this void in this area may be waived by an owner?
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. So it would functionally actually have the same impact as what you were saying, because the owner of the residence would waive it, or could waive it even if somebody else was inhabiting it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Is ours more expansive in it than like school or place of business?
Yep. Ours is more expansive than what the statute says.
I might suggest that we add owner or entity, because as a school isn't going to be necessarily owned by somebody. It's going to be an entity like a school board that could then waive it. Yeah. That might be a good clarification to make, since ours is more expansive. But sure. I don't think it doesn't go back in the direction that you're concerned about either. So.
Yeah, and most of these will probably have multiple editing things. I just kind of toss it in there to quickly so we can discuss it without putting much thought into these items, for the most part.
I don't know what the right term is for an organization like that that owns something. Just as long as entity doesn't mean whoever happens to be there on a given day.
Right. Yep. Sure. And we can...
seems to have a key.
Yep. Yeah. No, I understand that, and I don't think that would... I'll definitely look into it and help with that one too, but we'll make sure we get it worded correctly. I just wanted to bring it up, so next time I thought we just discussed owner alone. I think there might be... I just wanted to kind of throw it out there that there probably would be one other one to discuss, or to a business is going to have an owner, but like a school or something like that is maybe not going to have an owner. There would be somebody else that we could clarify, that make sure that they're allowed to waive it.
Yeah, it'd be a little worth looking into. I know it might just be the owner would be the school district, I suppose. But
it might be interpreted that way. I just...
Sure. Well, yeah, we can run through all that. Do you guys want me to give you a quick rundown from the beginning of the rest of these?
Yeah.
And I think the rest are going to be pretty quick. All right, so the first one, 6906-0101, I think that's pretty clear and easy. I wouldn't have even changed it except for the fact that we are proposing changing additional changes. It's just to clarify that now the Siting Act is two parts, as opposed to when this was originally promulgated, there was just 4922. So it addresses the electrical and the hydrocarbon side.
I'm back.
That was a quick meeting.
Starts at 10, apparently. It was on my schedule wrong, so I had to do the Jack Nicholson.
Council, I object.
I'll just keep moving on to. I'll move on to 6906-0105. That's the designated agencies and officers. Some of these are just changes to the existing agencies and their names. For example, the Department of Health now is the Department of Environmental Quality, in addition to the Department of Health. So he added on that on there. The Geological Survey is someone who is frequently there discussed as well. North Dakota Forest Service was one that Pat brought up, and the Bureau of Land Management was one as well. And I did write down on the bottom before we walked in the meeting the 20th Air Force Wing as well, to be notified prior to some sort of, to provide notice that of a facility or an application to construct a facility in the state.
I don't have any objections to these. I just want to use this as the opportunity, because I don't look at this in every siting case, but a few of the bigger ones I have. And I don't know if I've brought this up a couple of times in the last 7.5 years, but I've seen some individuals on our list, like when we, not that this one has happened, these are always correct, but Office of the Governor, and then we mention, you know, Governor Doug Burgum, or whoever is the head of this agency. And some of those were outdated by 3 or 4 agency heads already. And so at some point, we really need to get these right. I know my wife just poked fun of something I showed her that was addressed to Tony Clark that I still get. And I don't want to be the agency that's that far behind.
You know, if you guys do decide to go forward with this would be a good time to update our list and who we're actually sending stuff to. Because I can tell you that one of the questions I had when we had the discussion with the DOD and the clearinghouse and so forth was, well, we contacted the Department of Defense, if I recall, and yeah, there it is, the United States Department of Defense. And I'm like, but I said, what address are we sending it to? I mean, what address would you like it to be sent to? Because you're clearly supposed to be notified already, and so.
So we're going to. You're going to get into the. Proposed additions?
Individually?
No, I think there are 4 at the end that are new.
Sure, and these are I really don't have anything to add except for these were just proposed by staff as suggestions. If you don't feel the need to,
what would be driving any of those in terms of would we have benefited by engaging with them that we missed something, or the process is already open in a sense, although they would have to be monitoring our proceedings to know whether or not they wanted to weigh in on something. But sure. I mean, is there a driving force on those four apparently?
I'll talk to two specifically, and that's the DEQ. That's just a new name. The Department of Health was split off in the DEQ and the Department of Health. And so now really we're probably more interested in engaging with the Department of Environmental Quality than we are with the Department of Health. Okay. And in fact, we've been sending it to the DEQ recognizing that. So that's just that's actually a minor change. The geological survey, I believe, is one because I think we do have a lot of engagement in citing cases with them due to structural.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, and that was one that they.
Landslide areas.
Right, landslide areas that we felt we needed to put in there.
Okay.
The Forest Service, I guess I'm not really sure for that one, but to be quite honest, if you look back throughout the history of the commission, we have had a lot of engagement through the siting process with the Forest Service, so I was kind of surprised that it wasn't on here already through our rulemakings and so forth. So I guess I didn't have any concern if the commission wanted to add that one. I'm not sure about the Bureau of Land Management, though. I'm not sure what the driving force behind that is.
I don't think I would want that one on.
Okay.
Personally. Just invites engagement at the federal level that
may be unnecessary.
Well, we have the other departments and Fish and Wildlife and Corps of Engineers, BLM, you know, a lot of land by the park, don't they? And a lot of that?
No, I agree. We already have other federal entities, but the broader the list, I think the more challenging it can become for industry as well. We don't want to miss anything. Well, I get that, but it's like, where does it end?
I guess if we feel like they have a logical time to stop in the spirit of transparency and trying to identify problems ahead of time, we should try to engage the agencies that may have issues. But and sometimes it helps to have notified them, and if they don't say anything, then, you know, they're bad. Then we say, well, you were notified. It's your fault for not engaging.
It can be better than having someone challenge something we've approved and is now under construction in court because now this agency has an objection and they didn't know when you were citing it.
But we also, though, I think assume that they're all going to handle it the same way. I don't think there are tremendous resources to all of a sudden have a particular entity at the federal level now heavily engaged in every case that we're doing. I don't think that would happen, but if it did, that would create headaches and consternation, because sometimes what happens when the federal level isn't founded on fact or based on fact, it's just, oh, here are the hoops you have to go through.
I don't think not notifying them is going to be the way to protect ourselves from that.
I think the driving reason for me to add any of these is the potential to that we've been missing something, that there's it's been proven that, well, we keep missing this over and over again, but maybe there is that driving. I mean, Department of Environmental, DEQ, makes perfect sense. And that was split into makes perfect sense. Geological Survey makes perfect sense. We're already engaged with them. I'm a little fuzzy on the Forest Service. I don't know what.
Well, that's a North Dakota agency that should be involved. I mean, they just should be. They have expertise on tree and shrub mitigation that we don't have, and they do send us stuff. I don't know how they get our information. They aren't on the list, but we do hear from them on occasion. And
sure.
And we work with them on the tree and shrub stuff, so I think that they should be on the list.
But I
think the more the better, personally.
I would prefer the federal Bureau of Land. Yeah, I think more does. I think the state entities I'm comfortable with the state entities. Just in, I can't say I'm wild about the Federal Bureau of Land Management, BLM, to be perfectly honest. Pulling them into the equation for consideration and thoughts. Just being honest.
It might be a good question.
Well, go ahead.
It might be a good question for Pat for why he included that one. Just some of the reasons that I can think of would be federal mineral interests and impact on those by anything, by a project. Or
that's not what we look at.
But I know some of the siting criteria you can't impact. Like with wind siting, you can't locate turbines that impact somebody's ability to develop coal development.
But to that note, wouldn't that also involve, for example, they have to get an easement for any of those
things? True. So, I mean, true.
A lot of this should be addressed through an easement.
And I was just throwing that out as a reason of why they might be, or tribal land might be another one, like a pipeline route that goes through an entity might be another reason why a federal Bureau of Land Management might need to be. But I think maybe that's one we put a question mark by and just ask Pat why he thinks it's really important.
I'll just say it again. I'm against adding BLM to the list.
And I could say that I don't think Pat put any of these forward. That when I spoke with him about these, that he had a very strong feeling about these were just suggestions. And I guess on that specific one, are you interested or not interested in having a BLM or staff propose it with the Bureau of Land Management?
I was fine with having them on, but I don't want the changes to fall through, and I really don't want this to be a divisive issue. So I'm okay with not adding them too. But I really thought they ought to be on because if they're going to fight something, in most cases BLM is pretty pro-development because they end up benefiting from it. But if they are going to have an issue with some project, then I'd rather know in the siting process than just have them litigated after we've made our decision and now the project is half built already.
I think
so. Yeah, I'm surprised they are already on the list because they do engage with us on a lot of stuff when they're involved with the companies on a lot of projects. So, I mean, we are going to keep them out if they have an interest just by not including them on our notification list. I think it just creates the potential issue of, fighting them later because we didn't notify them. But I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. I just think it's more thorough to add them.
So maybe for the purpose of this one, we can kind of consider it and go forward without it for the time being. Sure.
Can always circle back. I mean, it's not as if there won't be future opportunities, but I said my piece.
And we can chat with Pat, and if he feels that very strongly that this is something that needs to be added, then we can. And if not, then maybe we'll just move forward without it for the time being.
The difference I do feel, Michelle, I just want to clarify when you had talked about DEQ is the new name, and that's who we mostly deal with. But I see you still have Department of Health on here. We are going to keep them, right?
Yes.
You didn't mean it, because they would be very involved in, if there was some health-related issue with a gas processing plant or something. Yeah,
sure. Yep, everything else is really remaining, just slight changes in the name. The one thing, and this is probably where Brian was discussing earlier, this is probably where the 20th Air Force would probably be place if we were interested in notifying them as well. I wouldn't mind hearing the Commission's thoughts on that.
I don't think it's a bad idea at all. They're a huge player in North Dakota.
Right. In the 20th Air Force Wing, it is broader than just North Dakota, but it would send it up to, I think, a higher level of command.
You know, when the Air Force looks at contracting something, our federal delegation and all of Minot or Grand Forks will be heavily involved for years, trying to maintain their operations here. Mm-hmm. And then to be doing things around the state that might adversely impact their operations and cause them to move elsewhere with something or not develop something here that otherwise would have been developed here. It's a big issue for North Dakota what happens with that group. So I don't mind notifying them.
They did state that.
So Jack, I'm sorry. Would it be in an exchange for the U.S. Department of Defense? I mean, because right now we say U.S. Department of Defense. I wonder where federal organizations go.
The one thing that I will point out that at least I discovered that I did not quite have a better handle on before is that the DOD has their prerogative, the Air Force, even though they're interrelated, they're not. If we tell the DOD, I'm not sure if the 20th Air Force Wing really is notified and provided input because they're not always looking at the exact same things. The Department of Defense may be looking at broader national interests, whereas the 20th Air Force Wing might be looking at training runs as well, in addition for flight paths and so forth. And so, my discussions, and I think Brian's discussions, I think he'd probably agree with me too that they're not really interchangeable from that standpoint, even though they're interrelated. And so that's right. Kind of why we were thinking about adding that as well. So there'd be almost a direct line for the Air Force Wing if they have any concerns for the bases and ICBM to provide the input, as opposed to kind of going to the DOD and them asking the Air Force Wing.
And would it be better to rather than the 20th, or what is the name of the 20th Air Force Wing?
Right, and there's probably
would it be better just the base? Go directly to the base instead? That would be broad, regional?
Another thing I guess I would point out with that is we've kind of had interaction with the base in the past, and I also should say that I think in the last rulemaking, even though the Minot Air Force Base showed up, then the 20th Air Force Wing showed up, and they were talking about different things as well. And so It seems, again, there are local interests, I think, and then there are broader strategic interests, and they're not always, I think they're interrelated, but they're not always the same. kind of a different perspective on certain issues.
Julian, from our meetings with them, and I was going to this is exactly what I was going to say a little bit ago on this too, is that they are related, but it's more direct. And with the 20th Air Force Wing, their concern is more with the silos and impacts to the base, where Minot might only be looking at the impact to the, if it's going to affect air traffic and runway and their flight patterns. The Minot Air Force Base, while they house personnel that do the missile silo thing, they are really two separate entities. So the 20th Air Force Wing, I think, has a little bit broader outlook on things and a different prerogative. So like that Jack was saying, they're all very different, and the 20th Air Force Wing will communicates with the Minot Air Force Base very well when there's an impact in the area. So I think it is the best and cleanest way to add in and get everybody locally involved.
Yeah, I guess the best way I would describe it is overlapping strategic interests on these matters.
If we're going to do this, would it be problematic to reorder these so you'd have kind of federal agencies in one group and like economic development kinds of things and North Dakota environmental groups? You read through these and it's hard to find who you're looking for, kind of. But I don't know if that's a problem or not.
I guess for implementation of the law, it's not a problem. But if we do feel the need to reorder them, it can be done. It could be done right now too, with a proposed rulemaking.
I don't know if that's. It just popped into my head, so never mind.
So, are we comfortable with what I have here? Is the changes up to 27? Everyone is all the commission is comfortable with it. The DEQ, the Geological Survey, the Forest Service. I think the commission is fine with proposing it and adding the 20th Air Force Wing for notification requirements. I haven't heard any opposition to that.
Okay.
This is a silly question. Does that cover the Grand Forks Air Base too?
The 20th, they are also, I believe, part of the 20th Air Force Wing as well.
Okay.
I believe so.
We'll double check, though, before we go forward with this.
I was assuming so. If not, we need to add them, too.
I think that is the case, but it just...
I think so.
I believe so, because I think that's largely their only mission okay. that they have left up there, whereas Minot is still... I still think they operate a bomber yeah. and flight aspect, where Grand Forks, I think... I don't know. We'll look into it, but yeah. double check.
Yeah. All right, moving on to 6906-0106, the siding fee refund. I know Commissioner Chrisman already discussed the $50 processing, the removal of that. But are there any other concerns with this? I know this is something that Pat proposed and felt.
So we're not removing
the $50 refund portion? Sorry.
We're going to continue refunding, correct?
Yes, and this actually just makes it clear that we will be processing refunds for less than $50.
Okay.
Even though the tax department doesn't. But.
Changes that we're waiting until all siting processes and project inspections are paid to make a refund.
No, and I guess just for a point of clarification, this is I actually had quite a bit of discussion with this because I now I'm kind of recollecting that in the past, what happened is we were holding on to all of it a long time ago. Then I think around the time that I came on, and I think a few other commissioners came on, at that point in time, we started refunding the vast majority of it, except for $5,000 to finish a couple things, such as seating and inspections and certain small items at the end. And I think this rule is initially changed for that reason, that's where the $5,000, except for $5,000, the amount remaining. But I think what we're finding, especially for some of these larger projects, as well, is that it costs more than $5,000. And so we over forcing ourselves and pigeonholing ourselves to give everything back except for $5,000, and it takes $15,000 to ultimately finish up the final reclamation inspections and so forth on maybe. A very large pipeline, or if there are any other residual items that the commission deems important to have a additional inspection down the road, we've already given up the money. We have to ask for it back now, so it's really inefficient from that standpoint. And so all this does is it allows us the opportunity to assess the amount that we need to finish up, and then I still anticipate that we will be refunding the money on the interim. And I followed up with Pat on that issue. That we're not just holding on to the vast majority of the siting fees until 3 or 4 years down the road. It allows us the flexibility to provide that refund while not pigeonholing us to $5,000 to finish up everything.
As long as that somehow just doesn't flip, because what happened is one went the other direction because there was huge balances being kept by us and not returned for many years. So,
sure.
I don't know if we need to, in policy or something, make it clear that we're not to do that and get back as much as we can, save $20,000 or whatever. But yeah, as long as staff is being diligent about assessing fairly what we're going to need and return the rest, I'm fine with it.
Yes, I think we can do that at the commission's discretion. In effect, we could even change this language to a degree. To provide some additional, guidance for that as well, if you want to say that the commission made its discretion, for example, provide a refund of a certain the amount they found unnecessary to finish the reclamation and inspections and so forth. Drafted much better than that, but something to that note.
We don't need to hold on to $100,000 to do $15,000 worth of work, but we shouldn't limit ourselves to $5,000 to do $15,000 worth of work either.
Correct.
And we'll give small refunds, even though the tax commissioner doesn't give small refunds under $5.
Are there any... are the... So I'm assuming everyone is comfortable, the commission is comfortable with this one moving forward? Okay. All right. Hearing no concerns, 6906-0202. If you recall, we do receive a 10-year plan, and this is filed with the commission. we're getting big stacks of binders, 10 paper copies, and I know we're moving to an electronic system, so I was just trying to back this out a little bit, and I see already see another change I need to make in here, just saying they have to file a 10-year plan with us. And at that point in time, when we move to the electronic system, all I have to do is probably just file it through our electronic system as opposed to mailing us or FedExing us 10 binders full of paper.
I did a little victory dance, and I saw this one's Jack on behalf of John Hammer. So good job, I liked it.
Gotcha. And then, along with, I think this was a concern that you brought up a number of years ago, Julie. So pipelines previously, they used to provide 10-year plans, and then it was determined, and I think it was taken out of the statute that they would continue to do so. But I know at that point in time, and I think Pat brought this up and he recollected that you still felt that there's some sort of information that would be nice to have at the point of application where a pipeline came up. Not that they need to give us 10-year plans, but you could say, how does this tie into the broader system for you? He kind of pointed out, he's like, well, maybe since we're not doing this, and at this point in time, we could also discuss putting something in the application for pipelines, saying, not even necessarily a 10-year plan, but requesting broader information as part of the application.
Yeah, that's true. The 10-year plan provides kind of a perspective of the company, their holdings in the state, and kind of the bigger picture. And I guess I haven't noticed that that's been missing in the application. But maybe I'm asking those questions at the hearing, just in general, and getting the information that way.
It
could be.
I kind of think what we're doing in the hearings is working. To go through a bunch of work documenting this, and we see how volatile that whole industry is. You know, look how much everybody's 10-year plans are different now than they would have been 6 months ago, even. I don't know that it's. I would find a lot of usefulness in it.
All right, sounds good. At least that portion will probably scratch. We'll leave the 10 copies being removed. Then just following along with that, 6906 or 401, you can see I took out the 10 copies from there as well. And then there was one thing that Pat noted as that he would like to have changed, and just an addition in under sub N. Or 2N, where the information must provide the location, the proposed facilities, the proposed site, and the criteria evaluated. I think there were some, his issue is that he's been receiving GIS data and maps at times with not this information, and really that's the information he needs. And that's the information the analysts are looking to evaluate a site is, well, where are the exclusion areas? Where are the avoidance areas? Where is it at in the GIS? How can we map this stuff? And we also kind of use that to cross-reference when there's a facility that comes in with a footprint certification as well, to make sure that all the excludents and avoidance areas, or at least that we could know about some of them. So that was his recommendation. Are there any issues with that from the commission?
And was that previously supposed to be captured in the supported by appropriate references to technical and other written material available to the commission? And they just aren't doing that? Is that why you're adding this?
I think that's my understanding. Because I did read that through with him, and it said, well, it seems like this is all the information they'd have to provide to us, and I guess he's kind of, at times, he's had to hassle people to get it.
Yeah.
So it just provides some more specificity on those certain items. All right, here, no concerns with that. You'll find the same one for 6906-05-01. And then moving down to sub 5 or section 5, the width of the corridor must be at least 10% of its length, but not less than 1 mile or greater than 6 miles unless otherwise determined by the commission. We just thought that it might be appropriate to repeal this since we're having companies come in and asking for waivers of this or asking for something in alternative of this almost every single time. So it seems like something that was applicable a long time ago, it really isn't applicable to the current and the modern siting process. As you guys are well aware, pretty much most of our corridors end up being 200 to 250 to 300 feet max. And so, for example, he walked in yesterday with an example of a case where now we're issuing additional notices because someone asked for a waiver of that regulation. And then we end up having to make a finding about it as well.
Yeah.
I don't object to that. I do want to just bring up one thing on both this and the last one. When we eliminate the need to file 10 copies on paper, I get that. But because I don't see us using 10 copies. But I do see me using one, and I see others using them too. And so is this going to put us in a position where every single application, if we want a paper copy, we have to go nagging them and then wait for it to come, or choose to print it out ourselves?
It likely would put us in that situation the way it was envisioned, especially as we go to the electronic system. So if you do want to continue, we could say less than 10 copies, a paper copy, three paper copies. I know the vast majority of staff now is doing it all electronically. I probably pull an iPad if I'm doing a citing case or a laptop. I think a number of the commissioners are as well. But of that line of thinking, we could still request a certain number of paper copies.
I like them.
On the application, I do find that paper copies helpful. Not to say that I couldn't do without, but I mean, if we wanted to ask for three.
Sure.
Why don't we ask for four so we each have access to one and so that the staff has access to one?
Okay.
I actually don't need a paper copy myself, but it could be an extra.
Sure.
Maybe if I cut it in half. I'd rather use the iPad. I can navigate a heck of a lot faster, and plus when I'm traveling, it's really easy.
Sure. Nope. That's... No problem at all. We can do.
It's personal preference. I mean, it's hard to write on an iPad sometimes too.
Sounds good. Well, I'll move it to four copies then, based upon the feedback I've received. Probably we'll leave the 10-year plan probably as it is, just because that's not something we have a proceeding on.
Right.
Okay. I think it's great. I mean, let's try it. If nothing else, we're 99.9% of the time, I bet we knock out six copies that never really get used that much. We've got to move around anyway.
Can we just leave it at the commission's discretion?
Well, we would, but we would end up telling them over and over and over again how many we would want, as opposed to that just being automatically done from the application.
Well, I think what Steve's saying, and this was something I had thought of too before, and that is, shall provide four copies unless a different quantity, or quantity upon request, or
yep. I was going to provide an addition where we could request more, which we always could regardless.
Because on a big citing case, for example,
provide additional paper copies upon commission request. So we add the word additional to that sentence below it, and okay, we get four automatically, and we can request more.
Perfect.
I think we could cover most of the grounds with that.
That works for me.
Right. So the quarter,
just so we don't that four is the minimum, that we don't have to always go asking them, oh, we got this lecture now, could you?
Right.
And in the meantime, our clock is ticking.
Okay. All right, moving on to 6906-0801. I think this might have been the one we already discussed about the ICBM setbacks. The transmission 6906-0802, we discussed that one as well. The pipeline safety update, this is the common one that we do every year, every couple of years. I don't think that there really is much to discuss, except for the one item that is a little bit new, rather than adopting the most current CFR, is looking the pipeline safety update. The pipeline safety program is currently set under public utilities. I know there was a recent change to the compliance division, compliance and safety. I thought, well, if I just change that number to 10, that actually moves it to that new section, which, again, for the purpose of our jurisdiction, is unnecessary. It's really just more administrative.
Doesn't bother me.
Okay.
It happens to come out that it still stays 03-01, even in 10?
I'll double check that. That's probably not right. I did toss that on as a placeholder, whether we even cared to change it at all. Under probably the new section, I think that probably would have a different number entirely.
Okay.
690911, common pipeline carriers. This is something in general. There's been some confusion from the industry on this. So we have the common pipeline carriers, and some of them have been filing tariffs with us. Some have not. According to the statutes, it says that the common pipeline carriers will file tariffs with us according to the rules promulgated and provided by the commission, and we have never done that. And so that's why there's the confusion. And quite honestly, we don't have any chapter on common pipeline carriers, and so this would create a new chapter with this one section underneath it. But it essentially would just say, you guys will maintain your tariffs, and you'll provide them upon our request. And probably the only opportune times that we would receive a request is if there's a dispute.
So it's in law, but it's not in rules. Is that right, Jack?
The law says that the companies will provide and maintain the tariffs according to our rules and regulations, and that we've never promulgated rules and regulations on it. So half the companies are sending it, half, a quarter of the companies are calling us being like, do we need to provide this to you? And some just aren't. And
sure.
And okay. So this just says we don't need to receive those half because we normally don't take action. Every once in a while, if there would be a dispute, in the event we would request these items and they will have to provide them to us and they will be maintained by the companies in the meantime.
Good.
If that's been working, I'm okay with that.
No one has really known what to do. It's just kind of been a mishmash. So this will provide some just general guidance on that. I will note that too. The reason I was trying to find a place where I could put aside besides the new chapters, but I think we will probably have to do some additional evaluation. I was looking through a number of portions of the statute on the common pipeline carriers, and it did note that the commission will be promulgating rules on a number of things, or shall promulgate rules, and we have not ever promulgated rules on any of those items. So that might require some additional evaluation in the future, but for the time being, we'll start with one item. light mitigation technology, we've discussed that already. And these, that takes us to page 14. There are a number of items that I just kind of earmarked as topics of discussion in the past that the commission may want to discuss. I know Pat brought a couple of these other things as well. Starting off with telecom adequacy of service, the commission under statute does have some authority of adequacy of service. I know we've commonly butted up against this in the past, as in that it's not clearly laid out in law. I didn't promulgate anything like this or propose anything for the commission to consider just because I've kind of gotten very mixed messages in the past, whether we should do something or we shouldn't. So when there is a dispute about adequacy of service, I have been hearing, well, what's adequate? And then that's kind of hindered the commission, the lack of clarity to that degree. And so what I was just kind of bringing up is it worth discussing? Is it worth going out to our stakeholders and seeing if we could define an adequacy of service standard? I know a lot of states have them, and usually it's 48 hours, something like that, maybe 24 in some as well. So I'm just kind of teeing that up for discussion to see to what extent the commission has an interest in just engaging with the stakeholders on the front end and maybe for a future rulemaking, seeing if there's some place where the rural electrical cooperatives and maybe the other companies have some sort of meeting of the minds on this. I know one company likely.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't regulate RECs, though.
For adequacy.
RTCs.
Sorry, RTCs. I'm sorry. RTCs. I apologize.
Personally, on this one, it is a hole, but I think we have a lot of other that are bigger, and we've been working with Energy Languages. I believe the only one that we can enforce these standards on. We've been working with them in other routes, so I kind of kind of feel like the technology is ultimately going to take care of this for everybody.
Sure.
So I guess I would rather not use that time in this way, but I'm interested in the portfolio holders.
Well, I think we could actually do some things with adequacy of service on the cooperatives, but I don't have any proposals at this point. So, and you know, we discussed it some years ago and decided not to go forward. Now there's been a lot of technological and other changes in the industry. Why don't I follow up with them? Let's not do anything for now, but I'll
sure.
kind of follow up with them more and see once if I have any recommendations.
Absolutely, and I wasn't really bringing this up for the purposes of even doing it on the next rulemaking or even the following. And it's just to start begging the question with the interested stakeholders. And if it took a year to kind of get to some sort of comfortable conclusion, that would have been fine too. This was really, I asked Stacy if she had any thoughts or anything that would make her life a little bit easier with some of the things, and she brought this up as one item that would make it. Everything a whole lot more simple for her.
Well, I can appreciate that. At the same time, I don't view it as a burning issue either. And I think it's one of those things where not the next rulemaking, but you know, maybe
sure.
it'll just keep getting bumped along unless there's really a
and
driving reason from the public side of the equation. It doesn't seem like there is.
Sure. And what I found in the past, and it just struck me as kind of a good example. You said there's no burning reason, but if you have a home where you don't have cell service and you're served by the carrier that hasn't done anything, and it's months and months and months, and now your home is burning, and you don't have 911 service, it's a pretty big deal, and you wonder why doesn't your regulatory commission even have an adequacy standard after all these years.
And
but I know when those are such slim instances, and fortunately getting slimmer, when we've looked at it before, all the challenges with adopting adequacy standards in the past have caused us to do what we've been doing, and that's just try to fix these niche areas.
Yeah, and I guess I was just to follow up with that too, and to add on to that, this hasn't been a burning issue except for when it's become a burning issue, when we've had about 50 people without telephone service for a month and a half, and then all of a sudden you have about 50 complaints, and we're kind of an issue. Well, what are we going to do about this? And then at that point, everyone looks back to the well, what standard did we set for adequacy of service? And then we're back in the square one. We're like, well, we haven't set one yet. We'll have to have a discussion about this. And we push it back, but yeah, to that note, all I was looking for.
I kind of disagree with that, Jack. I mean, when we've had serious issues, we've pushed it with CenturyLink, and they made several $1 million worth of investments. And I mean, it wasn't in a speedy manner, but I'm not sure having standards is going to. It's going through the process of setting standards and then using them to. Trigger action is going to make things any quicker for CenturyLink. So I'm not sure in the end we get to a resolution for the public because we have tools we can use on our own now to force CenturyLink's hand, and we have done that in the past.
Sure. And I guess to that extent, I would, that's a fair statement, Commissioner, and it's not that we haven't done nothing, but I'll tell you that it certainly has, at least from staff standpoint, slowed down the ability to do enforcement or even to push the cudgel as well for even the specific probably customers. I think that's staff's perspective on that. But I certainly hear you, and I'm not saying we've balked at it by any means, but a lot of these have sat out for a long time, and then we've kind of come back to saying, well, what can we do about it regardless? What penalty would somebody be provided for what adequate service. So
right.
again, if this is something the commission doesn't want to go forward with, it's just something that one staff member brought up, and I said I would present to the commission for discussion to see if there's an interest of even engaging on it for a future rulemaking down the road.
I'll kick the dirt around a little bit and see if what's changed and if there's any good ideas out there.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'll leave it to you, Commissioner, then, as opposed to staff. All right. The other issues, finalization of turbine locations. I know there was some concern about that in the past. Pat brought it up. I think Commissioner Crisman, you might have noted that it would be nice if there would be turbine location finalization at the time of the hearing, so forth. I'm not sure to what extent the commission wants to really go after that, but I did want to bring it up since it was discussed in the past.
Can we require that?
Well, and I guess that's when... that is one issue that I know I did discuss with Pat. For the most part, is I was like, well, it seems contradictory according to the commission's interpretation of how that operates and how they have been operating with the footprint law. However, I think when it comes to taking some sort of action to protect the public interest, if there is an overriding concern, I think the commission, the footprint law requires the companies to certify and to still continue to operate within the constraints of the commission's order and so in the commission's requirements. So if that was a requirement, that would be an additional thing that they would need to require to certify prior to doing a footprint certification. If that's specifically what you're speaking to, Commissioner. However, again, it was just...
I think we have significant pushback from the industry on this one.
Sure.
Flexibility in the micro-siting seems to be something that they value a lot. But, I mean, that's my initial thought on it.
And I don't know either whether it's worth the fight. I sure think that it shouldn't have to be this hard. It seems to me when you're citing something that is so big and so visible and so impactful to people locally, you should be able to provide a map and show them where it's going to get built. And yet, I don't know, they drag their feet on it and just make it practically impossible. And I don't know that it's worth the fight either.
And I'm not sure how much of an issue this is as well. I think for the most part, the companies are providing us pretty concrete location. I mean, there are modifications. I know as they construct it, concerns arise, whether it's a unanticipated discovery or a new environmental thing that they think, or just a landowner concern. A lot of times they're looking to move things in those instances. And
when we go out and have a siting hearing and we have them bring their big map and people look at it, people that attend that, they don't realize all these details and flexibility and, well, this is a proposal, but they're going to still be micro-siting. And the people look at that, and they think this is the plan that we're having the hearing about, and this is where the turbines are. And these don't bother me, or these do bother me. But I just don't know that we can prevail.
And not to speak to a specific instance, because my recollection is a little bit grainy on this, but I feel at some point in time that we have had an issue where we ordered the specific locations to be followed, and then shortly after that, the company wanted to move them due to a landowner request or maybe some other sort of construction-oriented impacts that they were trying to avoid, and it kind of just created an additional process where someone had to come to move something a couple hundred feet. So I'm not sure. Just to provide a little more context of whether we would or not want to do that, I did want to put that out there as well. So I'm not seeing a whole lot of interest in this one.
I think we have more pressing issues to focus on.
Randy, your microphone
is on. Sorry about that. I think we have more pressing issues to focus on.
All right. Hearing nothing else.
Unless somebody really wants to move forward with it, but.
Again, that was just something that Pat wanted to float for your general discussion, I believe. Moving on to the certificate of site compatibility. So, this is my gathering of past discussion that we had. So the siting amount is set at the amount of investment, the amount that they're providing for application fee to process the case is set at relative to the investment in the actual project. And so I think what he's looking at is redefining the investment as investment for the entirety of the project. And to provide, again, flesh this out a little bit more, I'll provide you some hypotheticals. So if you come in with a refinement plant and you put it, build it at 49,000 barrels per day, and then the capital investment is very large. Now, if you come in later and move the threshold up to, with the additional addition to it, move it up to 55,000 barrels per day, and now you're meeting the, you've gone past the threshold and now you need to be sited, the actual investment is a lot smaller that you're putting in there. It might be a minor change, a minor tweak, and maybe it was only a $500,000 addition. So if you're basing the application fee upon the amount of investment that's been placed in the facility at that point, what sometimes the companies are doing is giving us a $500,000 investment, which, of course, to look at the entirety of it and process it and maybe hire a consultant and such things, it requires some additional funding. So he was saying, well, what it should be we should be doing is, since we're setting the whole capital investment of the whole facility, the whole brownfield site, as it should be defined as that for the purposes of giving us a siting fee. And I guess another example on the transmission side would be a gathering to transmission line, where someone is putting a couple pump stations on to a existing gathering line, making it now a transmission line that needs to be sited. And sometimes that's a very small sum of money. The application fee comes in small. What this would do is provide, I think, the director an opportunity to say, well, no, it's the whatever the investment of the entire facility was, because we have maybe a couple hundred miles to cover, that's what we need to process the case, because we need to, have construction inspectors cover that whole ground and so forth. So I think he felt that this was something that would aid him in processing the case, as well ensuring that we have enough money to actually do that.
In the instances of the addition of, say, a couple of pump stations, and maybe I'm not completely following, but say a company wants to add, let's just say a pump station.
Sure.
On an existing line. One of the things that we talk about is it's not a review of the entire system. It's a review of that small parcel of land. It's a review of that pump station, et cetera.
I think what I'm noting is specifically a gathering to transmission, not an existing transmission line that you add a pump station to.
Oh, okay.
So a gathering transmission line, you could have a 100-mile gathering line, and when we do site it, no one has done the environmental review on the whole thing. So now there's a couple pump stations, and now we are reviewing the entirety of it.
Okay, got it.
And although the case I'm thinking of, I think, was one of the really cooperative companies that provided us the resources we needed. But I recall specifically one siting case on a gathering line, the transmission line, where there was one or I think it was even several instances where it was within 500 feet of residences. And now those residences were opposed to it. They didn't want this to become a transmission line. And it was a pretty extensive hearing process. And like I say, I think they were very cooperative in helping us have the resources we needed. But under the existing laws, it would have been tough to force them, I think. So I think this does have some merit. But at the same time, can it be done in a way where we have some flexibility, too, if it's some short little thing where, there isn't much of an issue going on, but there was significant investment years ago. It might be more likely in the case of a conversion facility. All the investments there, it's been running perfectly fine. Now this little change barely changes anything. What would be really the environmental impact of it? And so do they need to provide us with operating money as if it was a $1 billion project? Maybe not. So
we certainly could draft it. Sorry, go ahead, Julie.
Aren't we doing this in law? I mean, it feels like we've tackled this a bunch of times, and we had some changes addressing this issue for legislation, too, didn't we?
There is the proposal to allow us to request up to $25,000, I think is what the legislative proposal was, in the instance that $10,000 isn't enough to process the case without going to the emergency commission. So to similar concerns, yes, I guess we are trying, I guess, tackling on a couple different avenues.
Well, if we can do it through rules, why don't we do it through rules and not have the law change? But do we need to do it both ways?
Sure. I think this is an overlapping thing, even though there are additional instances outside of that for the additional $25,000. For example, if there was just a small line and we ended up having a $10,000 fee, there was the concern that in certain instances where maybe it's more controversial, we end up having to have multiple hearings and an ALJ, hired counsel, plus the consultants to, even on a shorter line where the capital investment isn't large, it would go over $10,000. But I'm not sure where we even landed on that. I'd have to look back at my notes whether we decided to go forward with that. Do you remember that, Brian? I know it's
I think we decided that it was the volatile time in the industry and going back, I thought we decided to wait.
Sure.
So another session or two, and because this was more of a prospective problem than an actual problem that we've experienced over and over. So when the legislature asked us, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have we've had these five examples of where we're short of money.
I think that's right. I think that is, I do recollect from the legislative discussion, that's where the commission ended up, is not going forward with that item. So I think what this would do is probably hit those very specific instances that are part of that broader concern if the commission wanted to do this with the rulemaking.
But it might cause them to think we're just going to be taking advantage of them and really push back. I had previously kind of forgotten about that they had provided that we can get up to $25,000. And maybe that does cover it for now rather than getting into a battle over this.
I think my recollection is the commission decided not to go forward with that piece of legislation.
So we don't have the ability to seek it?
We already got that.
We don't have the... So, for example, if we bought them out and have that $10,000 citing fee application, we'd have to go over to the emergency commission to get the additional amounts. Oh, I think what we did was we're drafting it, if agreed upon by the company, that they can provide an additional amount necessary to actually finish up the application process. I think that's where the commission ultimately ended up.
Well, maybe that's what we should do in law and have it that if it's agreed upon by the company, because, I mean, let's say there are times when the company wants us to have the resources because they want us to be able to process this quickly.
Right.
And so maybe that's how we should draft a rule change, but that it's based on the company's cooperation.
Sure.
Rather, because I like that a lot better than going to the emergency commission.
Right, and I think the company as well, rather than waiting to go to the emergency commission, if that holds them up a month or two to get
that fee necessary. That could be quite a time delay depending on the timing of things.
I think that cuts back a little bit of the red tape time-wise at least. But I guess, so for the standpoint of this, the redefining the investment to address those two instances where probably goes over a siting fee threshold or where there's probably a transition from a gathering to transmission line, is there any interest in defining the investment amount for that so that it's clear?
Why don't we just do what Randy suggested, which is come up with some permissive language that says if the company agrees, you can request more money.
Okay, I think that's already in the proposed legislation, so I don't know if we need to probably double up on that then.
No, he's saying
do
it in a rule instead of the...
I thought.
Well,
is that what you're saying, Randy?
Yes.
So we would probably want to do it between the two in statute because the statute provides those limitations. This is an interpretation that provides us the allowance of it. So if you're asking me whether we should do that change that we're doing in through legislation, through rules or legislation. We should do that one through legislation.
Okay, then I'm okay with doing it in legislation. But I like that where we're working with the company.
Right.
As opposed to just setting this based on the original cost. I think that's the better solution.
Okay. All right, and there's just one last small item, and that's about transcriptions. In our rules, it says that we transcribe oral arguments. And quite honestly, we don't transcribe oral arguments. What we have been doing to kind of address that is we've been asking if anybody would like to have a transcribed prior to the hearing. And usually no one really responds because ultimately it's electronically recorded at this point in time. So this is just a minor change to kind of address that so that we don't have to request it prior to the hearing. Everyone just knows that if they need to request a transcription afterwards, they probably need to do it themselves. And there's electronic record already.
I'm okay with that.
Okay. All right. I think we ran through all of it. Now, is there anything else that a commissioner or staff would like to toss up? Brian, you got anything?
I'm good.
Yeah, I think we both have notes on this too. So
yeah, I think we should circle back around. I think Brian, are you going to check on the 20th Air Wing? I did just some quick search. If the intent is to include Grand Forks Air Base, I don't believe they are included in that mission. And if it's for ICBM sites, and that's the intent of reaching out, which I know it is, but if that's exclusively related to ICBM, that'd be the 20th.
It's not. I don't think it's exclusive. It's the problem we're dealing with, but I think there's other concerns that air bases have, and they've illustrated
right,
in other
right.
states and stuff, too, that impact runways and development and things like that. So we'll make sure that... I'll follow up with our military contacts and see if they can point me in the right direction if there's an additional one.
Than that, because then you also get into like the 119th Wing, which is the Air National Guard out of Fargo. You got the Grand Forks Air Base, which I believe is a different mission than under a different. It could be. I think it is from what
okay.
I'm reading. Anyway, you'll check it out, so we'll be covered.
I will do that.
Okay, perfect.
I've got to take off. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. All right, that's all I have. We'll see what we can do about promulgating these rules. To be honest, I'm probably going to run these separately from the weights and measures because I could see these getting a number of comments. It could take a little time to respond. I don't want to hold up the weights and measures as a result of other controversial rulemakings when that one likely will have less feedback.
That's smart. And then we have a little more work to do then on... the first topic that we covered. The FAA language. So. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Anything else, Commissioner? Okay. Then we are adjourned. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.